Okay. Last week and the week before, I gave out handouts. I'd like you to get those handouts out. If you don't know what I'm talking about, the two handouts are here at the front of the room. That means you can leap from your feet and rush up here and grab one of each, or one of the ones that you don't have. There's one on prophets, there's one on kings, and you're going to need both of those. Okay? I'd like you to look first at the prophets list. Hey, welcome. Come in. We are talking about handouts that are up here. If you'd like to know what we're talking about, you can come rushing up and grab one of each. And then you can sit wherever you like. Okay. So the handout on prophets, on the left-hand column are prophets that came out of Judah. On the right-hand side are the ones that came out of Israel is on the left side, out of Judah is on the right-hand side. I think that's reversed from the order of the kings. I think in the kings I put Israel on the right and Judah on the left. Okay. So, look at the list of prophets. The first of the prophets that we're going to be dealing with, and that's going to be today, 1 Kings 17 is where we're going to be starting, is Elijah. Where was Elijah functioning as a prophet? I'm trying to make sure you know how to read these things. You okay? He was in Israel. The second prophet, Elisha, where was he?
Israel.
In Israel. Jonah?
Judah.
Nope. He came from Judah, but he was a prophet in Nineveh. So I'm putting you on notice. I'm telling you where the prophets came from, not necessarily where they're serving. Everybody okay? I'm telling you where they came from, not necessarily when. You got to sort of get further into it to see that. All right? Where is Obadiah?
Judah.
He's at the very bottom of the list. What does that tell you? He's one of the last of the prophets that we have. He's actually in the exile period, in the post-exile period. He's in the post-exile period, we think. Okay? Where is Elijah in that time sense? One of the early ones. Everybody see that? You're going to need to hang on to that piece of information for a while. So far, okay? All right. Now, if you go to the second handout, the one on the kings. If you look on the first page, which is the one with the big paragraph and four names below it, this tells you something of the purpose of this handout and something about how to read the handout, and then it lists the four kings who were kings of the combined nation. With Rehoboam, the kingdom split into two parts. If you now turn to the back page, you'll see on the left-hand side the kings of Judah, and on the right-hand side the kings of Israel. So far, okay? Next to the first listed king of Judah in the separated period, his name was Abijam, I think we decided to call him last week, although we could have pronounced it differently. To the right of his name is a date, and to the right of that is a section for comments. What's the comment in that section?
Son.
What does that comment mean?
Son of Rehoboam.
He was the son of the previous king, and if you look back a step, that was Rehoboam. All right? Who's the next king? Asa gives a date. What's the comment? Son. What does that mean? He's the son of Abijam. So far, okay? Everybody all right? All right. Would you come down, please, to Uzziah? This is 781 if you need to keep track of the dates. By the way, these dates are all in B.C. dates, which means that if you go from 870 to 780, is 870 earlier or later than 780?
Earlier.
Excellent. Just trying to make sure that everybody's straight on this. Okay? You're down at Uzziah, right? Over in the comments, what's the first word it says? What does that mean? Son of whoever was the one right before him. What language mark follows the word son? That's a semicolon. That is not a colon. That's a semicolon. What does a semicolon accomplish for you in literary or language terms? Stops one thought and gets you ready to start another thought. Right? So, what's the next thought Isaiah. It does not son colon Isaiah, as in Isaiah was the son of this king. It's son semicolon, new thought, Isaiah was a prophet during the reign of this particular guy. I want to make sure you don't misread this. I've had people misread this. Everybody still okay? Okay, good. Would you come down the right-hand side and find Ahab? Can you find Ahab? Good. What is the first word in the comment section?
Son.
What does that mean?
He's
the son of Omri. So far, okay. What's the next diacritical or language mark?
Semicolon.
What's the next word? What's your conclusion?
Elijah's
not his son. Elijah was a prophet who was functioning during Ahab's reign. We're about to talk about Elijah, who was king. Very good. Where was Ahab king?
Israel.
In Israel. What's the other nation that came out of the split?
Judah
or the southern kingdom. So who was king in Judah?
No.
Jehoshaphat. Listen carefully. Israel ends in the destruction by Assyria. Much, much later, Judah ends with destruction by Babylon. Everybody okay? If I list them in order of dates, it's too long to fit on a page. So I've compressed them to where it turns out you've got this many and this many. It's about the same number. Everybody still okay? But you got to line up the dates. So Ahab was 874. Jehoshaphat was 870. Probably Jehoshaphat and Ahab, most of their reigns were overlapping, or at least the central part. So Elijah was prophet to the northern kingdom. He'd come out of the northern kingdom. And Ahab was the king of the northern kingdom of Israel. And at that time, first Asa for a little while, and then Jehoshaphat for a while was king of the southern kingdom. So you're going to see Jehoshaphat, you're going to see Ahab. I'm just trying to orient you. Everybody okay? All right, have you found 1 Kings 17? Because if you have, we're ready to start. There's a whole section I should tell you about prophets, but I decided not to take the time in here. If you go to the website where the lessons are, you'll find a little section about prophets. You might profitably read that. No pun intended. Okay, chapter 17, verse 1. My first word is Elijah. Is yours?
No.
Yours now. Okay, but Elijah comes pretty soon.
Yes.
Okay. Where is Elijah from? No, he is a Tishbite. Where is he from?
Tishbe.
Everybody okay? He is from Tishbe. He is therefore a Tishbite. Right? Okay. The end of the first hour, one of the people in the first hour came up to me and said, I expect to be in Tishbe next month. Big crusader up castle up on the hill. Tishbe's. It is a dig sort of down at the foot of this big hill. I expect to be there next month. Interesting, don't you think? I thought that was cool. Where is Tishbe? Gilead. Where's Gilead?
In Israel.
I don't know.
Gilead is east of the Jordan River. East of the Jordan. If you go east of the Jordan River, do you get closer to the Mediterranean or do you get further away? You get further away. Very good. You're not geographically kept challenged like I am. All right. Gilead is very close to Rick and Margaret. You're off the hook for this one. Rachel, you're off the hook for this one. But Paul, you're on. Okay. And you guys are on. Gilead is really close to the Jabbok River. J-A-B-B-O-K. Okay. Any of you remember the Jabbok River? You're off the hook too. You're supposed to remember the Jabbok River. The word Jabbok is a transliteration. Its meaning is wrestling. It's called the Wrestling River. Does this bring anything back?
I was here for that week.
Were you here for that week?
I drew something on the board.
I did draw something on the board. I drew east of the Jordan River. I drew the Jabbok River.
Wrestle with God.
Who wrestled with God?
That's what I'm trying to
Jacob wrestled with God through the night, or with an angel of the Lord, or the angel of the Lord, to sort of take your pick how you make sense of that section. But that wrestling with God through the night occurred on the banks of the Wrestling River, which is a fascinating little piece of information. We talked about this way back then. Gilead is out in that country. It's out a little further, we think, from where Jacob was when that moment occurred. But it's out in that direction. Right? So far, okay? My translation says, Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab. Who was Ahab?
The king.
Ahab was the king. Elijah speaking to the king.
It says confronted.
Confronted the king, it says. Okay? How easy is it to speak to the king?
You gotta get through.
The king is going to have gatekeepers, and you're going to have to get through all that. How did Elijah get through all that? It starts with W.
We don't know.
We don't have a clue. The Bible is very spare here. We are given very, very little information. This guy comes almost out of nowhere. No hint that he is of nobility. No hint that he is of royalty. No hint that he has any connections with the king in any way. Just suddenly, there he is, speaking to the king. Okay? And what does he say to the king?
Not going to rain.
By the life of the Lord, the God of Israel, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain these coming years until and unless I give the word.
I better run.
We're going to go there right now.
That might have got his attention.
I believe it would get his attention. Number one, that sounds arrogant. What's another word that could be used?
Crazy.
Crazy could certainly be used, but I think there's a better one. Confident or prophetic. The guy's a prophet. He's confronting, and the word he is given is word that he has confidence in. Somebody said one time, it's not arrogance if you can really do it. Okay? So he's speaking to the king, and he says, now, if there's no rain, there still might be some dew. If there's no rain and there's no dew, what's going to happen? Crops aren't going to grow. If the crops don't grow, what happens? People starve. Not only the people, the horses that you depend on for part of your military power aren't going to be able to eat. They're going to die. You might flag that one. We're going to see that a little bit later, too. The economy is going to collapse. The people aren't going to be able to, you're going to be ripe for the picking by some military power coming in. This is awful. What do kings usually do when people give them this kind of message uninvited? The term is called shoot the messenger. Okay, there's an ad running on television. I saw it during a football game yesterday. A wonderful, fabulous football game with an unexpectedly interesting ending,
right,
about which I will speak no more. and you can't either. But during that thing, I saw an advertisement on television. I do not know what they were advertising. But they showed a guy sitting at a table, a whole bunch of other people at the table, big boss at one end. Big boss has just presented a plan for what's going to happen. And everybody around the table is saying, have you seen this ad? Oh, great plan. Great plan. Good plan. This one guy says, that's a terrible plan. It has no chance of working. And the next, just fraction of a second, you see the same guy standing outside the building with a big name on the wall, and he's carrying something, walking away from the building towards you. What's he carrying? A box with all the stuff in it. Okay, what just happened? Just shot the messenger. Okay? Except in the case of Ahab the king, it's likely to be execute. So far, okay? Yes, sir.
I was just curious, too. Do you have any idea? I mean, I've got my guesses about where Jezebel was at this time, because I don't think she had any problem coming into the king anytime she went into it too much, did she?
The Bible is very spare about what it says. If she's not lurking around, I lose lots of bets. She's either going to be there or she's going to know about it real soon. The picture that you get is a picture that that Ahab is somewhat weak and Jezebel is much stronger than he, and that does come out. However, as long as you said that, Ahab was king. Elijah suddenly, the way the Bible presents it, suddenly appears with a power that Ahab can't touch. And that power seems to be directed at Ahab. It's directed at the economy, it's directed at the working force, it's directed at the livelihood of the people, it's directed at the survival of his military abilities and stuff like that. All this is suddenly under threat. And I want you, not today, but as you read, I hope you read again, those of you who had the assignment of reading this already, as you read again, watch and see, is God dealing harshly with Ahab? Or is he dealing gently with Ahab? And I think you'll find interesting answers there if you take a look at that. Okay. If you want to conclude eventually he deals harshly, you'd be absolutely right. But along the way, keep an eye out. Something very interesting is going on. Okay. Verse 2. The word of the Lord came to him. I criticize my students for undefined pronouns. And there's a spectacular undefined pronoun here. Is the him Ahab or Elijah? Pretty clear it's Elijah by the rest of the context, right? The word of the Lord came to him. What's the word? In a paraphrase, run for your life. Run for your life, right? Where's he supposed to go? East. What's east? Remember, they're over probably at Samaria. By the time we got through the section Samaria, the land for Samaria had been purchased. The previous capital, Tirzah, had been collapsed in a pile over the guy who was king for 7 days and ended up killing himself in the center of the building. We went through all this last week, right? So probably Samaria. So he's going east from Samaria. What's east from Samaria? Jordan River. And what does it say? Go east and hide by the torrent, mine says, of Cherith, east of the Jordan. So go to the Jordan, cross the Jordan, keep going until you find a place. My translation calls it torrent. I'd be willing to bet large amounts of money, unless you have the same translation I do, yours does not say torrent. So I want to know what yours says. Stream, yours says. Brook, I was told, some said. Stream. Brook. Torrent. Are these words compatible and equal?
No.
No. What does torrent suggest? Lots and lots of water moving with some power and probably with some turbulent motion. What does stream or brook imply? Little bits of brook. Little deer sipping from the water. Right. Are there any other words? Because I think somebody said in the first hour there's another word that's out here. Does somebody have ravine?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's you got to say so.
Cherith Ravine.
Cherith Ravine, right. If you have a ravine, if there's tons of water pouring through it, you can get this kind of thing. It's like one particular place, probably not a waterfall the way they describe it. It's more like white water at a level you wouldn't want a canoe through. Okay. And how much water? Mine uses the word stream there, but it uses torrent back up here. Typically, there's little eddies and little places where you might be able to. It says, go east and hide by the torrent of Cherith east of the Jordan. You can drink from the stream, and I have ordered the ravens to bring you food or to feed you there. I don't know what that means, except somehow he's being providentially provided and the birds are involved. That's happened before in a few places, but it's very, very special. Verse 5, so he set out and did what the Lord had said. Elijah is obedient. How long did he wait before he left? Probably not long. He's not a dumb man himself. He stayed by the torrent of Cherith east of the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread in the morning and meat in the evening. And sometimes it's, some translations, it's bread and meat in the morning and meat in the evening. Yours may be one of those. And he quenched his thirst at, and mine says stream, not torrent. So we found a little place nearby. Okay?
Yeah, that verse says the Cherith
Canyon. Canyon, your says. Ravine, it says. I like the word torrent added to that because it gives you a sense.
It was in the earlier one.
Yeah.
Changed it to canyon.
Canyon. Uh-huh. Okay. Verse 7 in my translation starts with the word but.
Eventually.
Sometime later, you said, the stream dried up. Why did the stream dry up?
No rain.
Streams have a way of doing that. I was told in the first hour that there was one translation that the back up there where mine said torrent said wadi. Wadi. W-A-D-I. If I understand correctly, in Middle Eastern countries, the word wadi means if there is ever a lot of water, this is where it's going to go. So if it's raining like crazy and you get flash floods, this is where it's going to go. And then in the meantime, it's a sort of a scoured out place. So go to the torrent, the water's going, now the water's dried up. The word wadi might actually describe that pretty well. You've just come from there. I should be leaning on your expertise, yeah.
In Egypt, they name like resorts like Wadi Denba. It means like Denba's the name, but it means like an area.
And am I describing it anywhere? I tried to get experts in the first hour. Nobody would.
Yeah,
if there's water, this is where it's going to go.
Yeah, for Wadis, like in Oman, and there's these just beautiful, lush, like valleys of places where, yeah, the water.
Where they do have water.
Pretty.
Out in West Texas and.
Similar, but it seems that it's more like there's more. Yeah.
There are some beautiful places and places that you think are deserts. They're not. I've seen some pictures of Morocco that sort of took my breath away. I've talked to some people who've been to Morocco. Yeah, that's what it looks like. Out in West Texas and other places like that, the cottonwood trees tell you where the water is. I don't know if you've ever been out there and looked. You see this line of cottonwood trees. You know, okay, there's probably a stream either in between the cottonwoods or right alongside them, because cottonwoods grow where the water is. So maybe something like that. But it's dried up. Verse 8, the word of the Lord came to him again. This time it's quicker. Up and go, mine says. Where's he supposed to go?
To
Zarephath.
Path of Sidon.
Up in Sidon, if you've heard of Tyre and Sidon. Mine says Sidonia, which is the land of the Sidons or something like that. If you remember in Philistia, there were five major cities with Ashdod and Gaza as two of those five. We're now up in the land of the Phoenicians, which is north and on the coast. This is the land of the Phoenicians, and Tyre and Sidon are two of the major cities up there. The fellow who said he was going to be in Tishbe next month said last month he was in Tyre. So he's in and out of that part of the country. Anyway, he's supposed to go to Zarephath in Sidon and stay there. And then he says, I have ordered a widow there to give you food. Think the widow knows? If you've read this, the answer is probably not yet. The order is still making its way. So, verse 10, what does he do? Once again, he obeys. Where does he go? Goes to Sidon. And when he reached the city gate, there was a widow gathering sticks. How does he know she was a widow? Does she wear a big W? I don't think so. Why? How would she? He know she's a widow?
I would imagine there's several things. The way she dressed. Gathering sticks.
Probably there was a dress that widows wore. Maybe that too. I don't know. But somehow he knew she was a widow gathering sticks. Addressing her, he said, please bring a little water in a pitcher for me to drink. Mine says pitcher, which seems to me odd. It looks like he would have said a cup or something like that. Yours says jar. Moonshine comes in jars. Somebody says cups. There's at least one that says cups. Yours says vessel. Okay. Bring me some water. She was on her way to fetching it. What does that tell you about the woman? She has recognized his right to impose on her. She was on her way to fetch it when he called after her. Please, he said, bring me a scrap of bread in your hand. I don't know why he said in your hand. Maybe, I don't know. And you can almost see her stopping and turning around and looking at him. And I don't know how to describe the look. But the look would be one of resignation, desperation, sadness. And probably the one thing that would not be there is hope. and she begins to speak. Read the next verse or two and summarize it. What does she say?
She only has a little bit of flour for she and her son.
I've got the last little bit of flour. It's enough for one meal for me and my son. I've got the last little bit of oil. It's enough for one meal for me and my son. I'm gathering the sticks to make the last meal we're ever going to have. We're going to eat this and we're going to die. How am I supposed to have enough for you?
She says something else at the very beginning, though, that's very... She reveals her recognition. She says, as the Lord your God
Thank you.
Lives.
Thank you. She has spotted spiritual authority, godly authority in this man. And she has recognized him as representing the God of Israel, the God of Israel.
But she doesn't say the Lord our God. She says mm-hmm. Lord your God.
Which is what a number of characters do who are not yet convinced. A number of Bible characters will use that language. Saul used that language a lot with Samuel. Please call on the Lord your God to do this or that. Okay. As the Lord your God lives, she said, I have no baked bread. There's not a crust left over from an earlier meal. I just have a handful of meal in a jar, a little oil in a jug. I'm just gathering a stick or two to go and prepare this for myself and my son to eat, and then we'll die. But Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go and do as you have said, but first make a little scone of it for me and bring it to me, and then make some for yourself and your son. For the Lord, the God of Israel, says, jar of meal shall not be spent, jug of oil shall not be emptied before the day when the Lord sends rain on the face of the earth. What'd the woman do?
She
obeyed and she did it. And they ate the food, she, himself, and her son. And you can almost hear the words between the words that are printed. And until the day that the rains came, the jar of meal didn't run out, the jug of oil did not run out, just as the Lord had promised. Now, there's a number of things that hit me in here, and since I'm up here, I'm going to take the privilege of sharing them with you. The first thing that hits me is I've heard words like that. There's a picture over on the sideboard of a couple of people who were, for a long time, missionaries to Africa. They are now retired, and they retired and moved into a house 2 miles from where they had been serving, and they've continued to do exactly what they were doing while they were missionaries. They're just no longer supported by the Baptists. And one of the things they're doing is they are training nationals, people from Kenya and Tanzania, to serve as missionaries to other Tanzanians. They have stood at this podium and they have talked to you on more than one occasion. One of the things they're doing is they're trying to address a drought that's been happening in another part of Tanzania, not the part where they serve, but the part that they have a vision for reaching. There's a drought out there. And what's happening is people are killing the trees, cutting down the trees to try to have something to cook their meals over. And the trees, the whole place is being deforested. When you deforest it, the weather patterns change. You don't get as much rain as you got before. It just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And she told us one day, and some of you should have been here at that time. I think some of you would have been here. She said, I talked to a woman, and I said, the trees aren't going to last very long. What are you going to do then? And the woman says, we will eat our last meal, and we will die. That's exactly what you're hearing here. It's not looking into the future as that woman was, but it's looking into the present. We're going to eat this meal, and then we're going to die. And Elijah says no. Second thing that occurs to me, Elijah says in verse 13, don't be afraid, go and do as you've said, but first make a little scone for me. Now, scone is not bread. Scone is much better than bread. Okay? He didn't say croissant. Mine says scone. Yours, I think, says cake at that point. Okay, small cake. And he says, do this for me first, then do these things for yourself. And it makes me think of an especially despicable, I'm using that word advisedly, I should be standing on my side, television evangelist by the name of Robert Tilton, who says to some of the poorest people in our country, just send money to me, and then God's going to bless you. And he quotes this verse over and over again, just beats into the thing about this. Does God do this sometimes? Clearly, yes. Does he do it often? I don't know. One of the people in the first hour came and said, I heard somebody on a country and western song talk about a guy in a white suit telling me to send money to God, but he gave me his address. That captures what I'm trying to say. Somehow in here, this verse I think has been misused by some people who live in fancy houses and drive fancy cars. And the people that they claim to be helping are not helped. And I think you can misuse stuff. There's one more thing that occurs to me. Where was this place? Where did he go? He went first to the torrent at Cherith, or the ravine or the canyon at Cherith. Where's he gone now?
Zarephath.
And where's Zarephath?
Sidon.
It's in Sidon.
It's a far away from where it was.
Right? Yeah. Sidon is way up north, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do we know about Sidon just in the last few? What did I tell you last week to remember about Sidon? You forgot it already, didn't you? This is where Jezebel came from. Where has Elijah gone to hide from the wrath of Ahab and almost certainly Jezebel? He's gone to Jezebel's hometown, or at least close to it, to her home country. That's where he's hiding. I find that fascinating. I find that really fascinating. And a woman of that country has recognized the spiritual authority that God has invested in Elijah. And then I think of one more thing. Elijah has the power, God has given it to him, to stop rain and stop dew. He's given him the power to make an audacious promise to a woman who thinks she does not have 24 hours to live. And it comes true. So what does this tell us about Elijah?
Pretty powerful.
Is he like you? Is he like me, or is he different from us? No, he's not. James 5:17 says, Elijah was a man just like me, just like us. And he prayed and it didn't rain for 3 years.
But there was something about him that she recognized the spiritual authority,
yeah.
And Ahab must have too.
And I'm not arguing that at all. But what I'm saying is, what was it about Elijah? It wasn't Elijah. What was it? It was Elijah's obedience that allowed God's power to flow. Can that happen to you?
Yes.
Yes. Can that happen to me?
Yes.
Yes. And that's the message I want you to see as we're going through this.
Bill?
Yeah.
In here, verse 14, the jar of flour will not run out, the bottle of oil will not become empty before God sends rain on the land.
Before the day when God sends rain on the face of the earth, might say.
Yeah. He's saying, not me. I will wait until God tells me.
If Elijah had believed the power was Elijah's, he wouldn't have run from Ahab. God says, run. I think it's a good idea for me to run. God says, stand and confront. It's a good thing for me to stand and confront. And I want to make sure, James' comment on this is powerful. Elijah was a man just like us, but he prayed, and God stopped the rain for 3 years. Yes, sir?
Yeah, he must have been a man of prayer, I take it, quite a bit. But maybe that's a big difference in him and us sometimes. But what I was curious about, too, I've been curious the whole way here, what do you know about... I know the Philistines had heard and seen what Israel had done some at this point. Phoenicia, had they really, was this woman kind of isolated? Did she need this God of theirs some? Or what do you think the influence, or was she kind of special that she got this insight there? Or was she like all of them knew it in Phoenicia, this area pretty much? Do you have any idea, clue about that?
What we've been seeing is that for something on the order of at least 40 years, maybe longer, the spiritual undergirding of the nation of Israel, both halves, had been just declining and declining and declining and declining, in the north especially. I don't believe anybody in Philistia or Phoenicia would have been unaware of what God had done in the past. It's always, I think, and I'm saying this to myself, not just to you, it's always, I think, a surprise to realize God's doing something right now, and I'm close enough to see it. But I think when God said, I have ordered a widow there to give you food, I think God is saying to Elijah, there's a woman in whose heart I'm already at work. And when you meet her, she's going to provide for you. If you keep reading, and I want to keep reading, in verse 17, you find out Elijah is living in her house. He has an upstairs room in her house. He's being taken care of. She's feeding him. The drought must be a little less there, or they've been able to find water some way, but they've certainly got the food that they can eat to keep them alive. Verse 17, mine says, it happened after this. What happened? The son of the mistress of the house fell sick. And the verse goes on to say his illness was so severe that in the end he expired. What does yours say?
Stopped
breathing. What is breathing? Respiration. When respiration stops, what do you call that? Expiration. Or at least close enough. Mine says he expired. Yours says he stopped breathing. They're saying the same thing. He's dead. What does the woman think?
Elijah's done something.
She's a widow. She has no husband to provide for her. What is her, the word of the day, hope? That her son will... Her son is now visibly, demonstrably dead. What does she think?
She thinks Elijah. She says, man of God, what do you have against me?
Now, you used your hand in a way that was pointing.
Yeah.
Okay? And I want to encourage you, look closely. I think at first blush, it looks as if she's pointing a finger of accusation at Elijah. I think she's saying something a little deeper than that.
She talks about her own sin.
She says, oh man of God, have you come here to bring my sins home to me and then to kill my son? What quarrel do you have with me? When you have someone of spiritual authority, as Elijah seems to have become with God's indwelling, the woman is saying, when you stand close to such a person, there's so much spiritual light that everything that's wrong with you gets revealed. You came here. You put yourself in my life. That means everything that I have is being exposed spiritually. That's what happens when God's light begins to enter. It begins to reveal all the faults. And she is as much as saying, I have deserved this, but I need my son alive. And that is a deeper statement that she's making. You start to realize God has chosen somebody really interesting here. This widow is a fascinating person. And she has said something in a fascinating way that reveals her humility, her recognition of her unworthiness, her appreciation for the blessings that she has received, but her recognition of the grace and the mercy that God has shown to her. And then she asks the prophet, you've lingered here. Was it your purpose to bring this about? Not so much, why did you do this? But what purpose is being served by this? And I think if you can hear that extra piece, I suspect both are present. But this seems to me to be at least half of what she's saying. What's Elijah's response?
Give me your son.
He is a man of relatively few words. He confronts the king, and what does he say? It's one sentence. As the Lord my God lives, it's not going to rain or have dew around here until I say so. He's gone. That's it. What does he say? Give me your son. What does he do with the son? Takes him from her lap, it says. He was so sick, his mother was trying to care for him, and he dies in her arms. Give me your son. He takes him to the upper room where he was staying. That's how I know that she had provided a room for him, where she was staying, and laid him on his bed. He then cried out to God. And what he cries out is a giant question to God. Wait a minute. This woman has given and given and given to help me stay alive. Do you mean to bring grief, mine says, even to the widow who is looking after me by killing her son? Implicit in that, I think, listen carefully, see if you see it, is I know you meant to bring misery to lots of people with this drought. Did your intention of bringing misery extend even to this one person who's been helping me?
Mine says something a little different. It says bring tragedy to her, which is much bigger
tragedy.
Than grief. We're talking about her hope is through her son.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is tragic to her in her life.
Do we have any idea how old the widow is or how old the son is?
The picture that you have is the son is still dependent on her and not an independent adult. But I don't know how old.
Mine says he took him from her bosom.
Mine says from her lap.
Yes. It's got to be a small enough child that you can get this. Yeah, he's not a 17 or 18 year old. I don't know.
My son is 6 foot five.
My initial thought is that she's older.
My son is 6 foot five, and I have seen my wife hold my son in a way that brings tears to my eyes when I remember it. And I hope you never get to the point where you have a moment like that. I don't think there's a clue in there at all about how old he is. I think there's a clue of how much his mother loved him.
Yeah.
I just don't know. I just don't know. But I think it hints that the son is young and that the son is small. And that's probably right. But I don't think that's necessary.
Here's your first boy?
Yes.
Yeah, some translations I think use the word boy. Mine says son.
I think the term widow often.
Mine says child in 21. Yours says boy in 21. Mine says child at that spot. He stretched himself on the child three times. I don't know what that means, and I don't know the significance of three times. Is there some hint of the Trinity in that? Somebody asked me last week who had actually read ahead. Not too many of us read ahead.
It says he stretched full length, not just laying, the boy was here and laying over, even down beside him.
And he cries to God, Lord my God, may the soul of this child, I beg you, come into him again. And three times he does it. And he revived. And Elijah took the child. So the word child or boy is used there. That implies, Judy, that he would be younger and smaller. Took the child, brought him down from the upper room into the house. Down from the upper room into the house. That implies that the upper room is somehow disconnected, like maybe a special thing on the roof. Brought him down and gave him to his mother. Look, Elijah said, your son is alive. And the woman replied, now I know. Up till now I have suspected it. Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth itself. Chapter 18, verse 1. A long time went by. And what follows we don't have time to do today. So we're going to stop at that point. What have we learned? Prophets generally don't get a good reception. Messengers get shot. But obedience sometimes requires the participation of somebody else before everything works out. I had a chance a week or two ago where interviewing some people for a position at our school. And I asked one of them, tell me about the person during your training that taught you the most about being a teacher. I said, not taught you the most about the subject of chemistry, but taught you the most about being a teacher. And this one candidate said, well, that's a really interesting question. And then she began to talk about one of her teachers and all the things this person had done that had shown her how to be a teacher. And she stopped and she looked at me and she says, you know, I don't think he has any way of knowing how grateful I am to him. I should talk to him, shouldn't I? And I said, yeah. We are who we are because of people who have helped us along the way. At the end of the first hour, somebody came and asked me if I'd seen the end of the Duke North Carolina football game on television yesterday. Have you seen that? Did you see the moment where the cameras went into the locker room for Duke and they showed David Cutliffe, the coach, looking at the young men who had won the game? And he said to them, I'm proud of you. You've done something that you'll remember all your life. But before you leave this room, I need you to think about the people who made it possible for you to be here and have this day. And sometime within the next week, I want you to call a couple of them and tell them you're grateful. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Elijah is so grateful to this woman, he looks at God inflicting this. And he says, God, why are you doing this? Do you know the answer to that question? Through the woman, God is taking care of Elijah. What's the message he's trying to send Elijah? Through you, I'm going to bring help to lots of other people. He's teaching in a way that you and I might not have chosen, but he's teaching. And that's what I want you to see. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Father, we're in a part of Scripture which sometimes seems strange and sometimes seems excitingly different from anything we've experienced. And yet the book of James says Elijah was somebody just like us. Help us figure out that being obedient and responsive to your call could make such a difference in the world around us. Teach us how to take the steps toward being fully committed to you and responsive to your work of your Spirit in our hearts. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.